Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello.
And we're going to continue our kind of musings on changes in the religious space by not talking about non-religious people, but individuals who kind of move into other, less orthodox, I guess would be the right word to put it, religious systems. We're going to talk about hyper-real religious systems. So I guess we should start by explaining what a hyper-real religion is. Do you want to define that?
Do you want me to do that?
I would appreciate it. I think you could do it better than I could.
Alrighty. So the scholar that's most known for hyper-real religions, or at least coining the term, goes by the name of Posamai, Posamai, okay. And they have a handbook on hyper-real religions.
Okay.
And so this handbook came out in 2012. And the definition is, a hyper-real religion is a simulacrum of a religion created out of or in symbiosis with commodified popular culture, which provides inspiration at a metaphorical level and or is a source of belief in everyday life. And so the first key word in this definition that I think is important is the simulacrum.
That's got to be the word of the week.
Simulacrum. And it comes from Beauregard's hyper-reality theorizing. And so this idea that we have, through the aid of advertising and digital media, have moved into the society of the spectacle, where symbols are more important than a grounded objective reality. And so we live in the simulacra, which is a world that is deficient of connections between our symbols and the reality that they're based in. And so one of the examples would be that rather than having a human in your life that you consider a hero, you look to like superheroes or Superman or Marvel heroes as like examples of what heroism is, essentially, or that the idea of representing or signaling or like wearing logos or your group's identification is more important than what you do in the group, that association and symbology takes primacy over the corporal behaviors in our day-to-day life. And so what's interesting about Beauregard's theorizing is that he was talking about France in the 60s and not the United States in, you know, the age of social media. And so things have ramped up quite a bit since
a little bit.
And so the hyper-real religions come out of this popular culture simulacrum that rather than like a church or a long-held family generational belief system or something tethered to like ancient mythology, that religion starts springing up out of popular culture and that are objectively fictional, that are then given power through this symbolistic interaction with people and those mediums.
Cool. Yeah.
So,
and we have talked about this. I mean, not the idea of the hyper-real religion. We were briefly in our discussion with John Steadman, but the idea of like love using the works of H.P. Lovecraft as part of Black Magic Ritual would be an example of a hyper-real religious practice.
Right, because the definition for hyper-real religions, either comes out of popular culture or in symbiosis with popular culture, which is that like theoretical distinction I think we've been talking privately about for a while.
Yes.
That there's a difference between, say, like a religion that comes out of a fandom versus like the Lovecraft, where you already have these religious systems in existence, like the Church of Satan or Aleister Crowley's church, cult, coven.
Yeah.
Secret society. Yeah, whatever you want to call it.
You already have a coven. You already have a set of rituals that you perform. And now what you're doing is you're taking the source material within this popular culture system and you're kind of merging them together in some meaningful way, where the religion exists or the practice exists, and now it is being modified in some way with the use of this pop cultural system. As opposed to the pop cultural system creating the religion or what's the word I'm thinking of for this, guiding it along or
spawning it.
Spawning it in some way, which is kind of tough to sort of suss out with that is that it can be very difficult because a lot of these like hyper real religions themselves or these pop culture phenomenon that spawn religious systems are themselves based off of pre-existing religion or their allegory in some way. So we could look at like people who follow the idea that we're all in a matrix.
Right.
If you watch the Matrix movies and don't go, that seems a little bit like Christianity, or there's definitely some Christian symbolism in this trilogy of movies. There's four now, but in the original trilogy of movies, I don't know what movies you watched, because there are definitely, you know, tied to that. And so if you're already Christian, you can adopt, or, you know, if you're developing that, they're based on, there's religious undertones to the whole movie.
I mean, you could also probably argue that, like, if we want to go union on it again, that these movies come out of the collective unconscious, and so Christianity is so embedded in that at this point that you can't help but to recreate the wheel with all of your fictional works.
Yeah, and I mean, and vice versa, if you're kind of using your religious understanding and kind of taking on new ideas, like you already have embedded in your own consciousness so much of your religious background that it's easier for you to adapt something to that than to kind of create something new. You already have this foundation. So
yeah. So that is, in short, it's fans who take their canon too seriously.
It'd be more interesting to kind of deep dive into some of the actual fans at some point in the future, because I wonder if there are people who are just like, I follow this thing, but I don't really follow any of the pop culture, but like converts, born again. So
like,
Jedi.
I don't particularly care about like the Star Wars movies, but the Force is totally real.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. So like, maybe that's our third dimension of fandom, fanship, and have a third one of like, I don't know, sincerity.
Well,
sincerity.
You know, I did a lot of work and a lot of discussion with Pat Edwards, and maybe we can get him on at some point to talk about it. When we were originally putting together the Brownie study and doing our fan research, he was very interested in the concept of neo-sincerity, the neo-sincerity movement, as being a part of fan culture. That you could be a part of the group, you could be a part of, you could be down with the interests, but there's something, at least within some communities, particularly within like the My Little Pony community, there's a lot of that like neo-sincerity movement, like meaning, purpose,
right,
building off of it, finding one's place. Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna call Possibly. It born again Jedi.
Born again Jediism. So before we, because I know you did a lot of homework for the Jediism.
I wouldn't say.
And for any of my religion students from the summer listening, most of them did Jediism for one of their podcast episodes.
Oh, cool.
And so I have heard quite a bit about Jediism in the last month. But I did want to start with an older one similar to Lovecraft, because there's not a lot of information on it, and I need to do a deeper dive to see who exactly are like the main people who believe in this. But it's Tolkienism. And so the basic idea is that they follow Tolkien's, I guess, muse for writing Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion and other works.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that his idea was to create a world and a story that would be a mythology for the British Isles, essentially, mm-hmm. right? that's kind of extended away from like Roman or Hellenistic mythology, that there's like a specific lore around the British Isles. And so you create Middle Earth, largely the entire what is Earth is also called Arda.
Mm-hmm.
And so followers of Tolkienism take seriously Tolkien's desire to create this mythology, but they believe that he uncovered the mythology and that the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit, the Silmarillion is actually Earth's history. And that that we are living in, I believe, the fourth age right now, which I'll get into. So there are deities. Yep. Well, there is a deity. And then there are supernatural beings underneath the deity that are kind of like angelic or prophet figures, if you will. And so the supreme deity is Eru Iluvatar, which created Arda, the earth, and everything in it, and is the bringer of life. Under him, or them, or it, is the Valar.
Mm-hmm.
Which are lords and ladies who are kind of like high angelic beings that do a lot of like the creating the forms of the earth, but are reliant on the supreme being to breathe life into those forms. And so you have one of these beings creating like the dwarves, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they can only make the husks of the dwarves, and they rely on the supreme being to breathe life into them. And then below the Vara are the Maiar, the Maiar, which are minor angelic beings that are you'll be regular viewers of Lord of the Rings would be familiar with some of these beings. And so Gandalf, Sauron, Radagast, the Balrog are all of these minor beings that operate within the world. And so this is kind of the structure, and the believers of Tolkienism say that the ages 1, 2, and 3 are the history of the world, and that at one point there were different races, and that there was magic, and that there was this intimate connection between divinity and humanity through the third age. The third age being where Lord of the Rings happens and ends at the destruction of the One Ring. And the idea is that the fourth age, the age of man, rolls over at the destruction of the One Ring, because that nullifies magic in Middle Earth, essentially. And so you move into a non-magical era, which we are currently in, where the elves have disappeared and the dwarves have disappeared, and you know, all of the angelic beings, etc., are all gone. There are no more rings, and we are forced to live in the age of man with this long history.
I don't know what I have to add to this. Like, as a huge Lord of the Rings nerd. It's wild to think about.
It's wild. No, that's what my thought was. And one of the things that came to mind with this, and I know this isn't like a literal one-to-one, but in my evolutionary psych class with Dr. Henley, we talked about, you know, like your basic Homo sapien and Neanderthal distinctions, but then the other two extinct humans that lived at the same time as humans, the Denisovians and the, I can't remember the other one, but one of them was a shorter human, and then the other one was a taller, skinnier human, and then the Neanderthals were like chunkier, broader humans. And so we joked around the class that those are the lost elves and dwarves and hobbits.
Yeah. I mean, they found that like race, the remains of what seemed to be like a species of smaller hominid that they named like after hobbits, like it's like Homo hobbitus or something like that. Because they were like, oh yeah, like they're small. They're like pygmy hominids. Hobbits,
right?
And so it's like, so Tolkienists would look at this and go, nope, they got the name right because that's who they were. They were hobbits.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hobbits existed. I don't know if I could take that leap, but I could see how pop culture would influence the naming of ancient remains.
Right. No, and that's kind of the thing that I think there are two, because when we talked with John Steadman, and he talked about how like so many people have now engaged in magical practice with the like eldritch gods of Lovecraft, that they've essentially like made them real, like those symbols have now become deities essentially that you can work with and pray to and as any other deity. And I think with the Tolkienism, because Tolkien was like immaculate and detail oriented and precise. Yep. Like you could read the Lord of the Rings as a history text.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially if you ever had the pleasure, and I'll say it because I didn't enjoy trying to slog through the Silmarillion, but it is written like a history book. It is very to the point. It is not as, I don't know, I found Lord of the Rings to be much more narratively fulfilling.
And The Hobbit more so.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. But yeah, it was The Silmarillion, and I'm looking on my bookshelf because I have a copy of it.
Okay, John.
I mean, like, look, when it comes to like Lord of the Rings books, yeah, I've got several, like, two copies of Lord of the Rings on my shelf. I've got the Silmarillion. I've got an annotated book of The Hobbit with a bunch of neat notes and like bits of information in it. I've got Tolkien's translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and The Pearl, and some other books by Tolkien that he did outside of Lord of the Rings, like translations and stuff. No, I'm a fan to say the least. But yeah. But I mean, I guess it is like, because that's gets to kind of one of those questions that when we talk about like religion and whatnot, is like, there's no use debating on whether it's real or not. For the person, it is real, and that makes it real. That makes it exist within the realm of their reality. And even though we might not be able to conceptualize that reality, it can be real. We can understand the kind of psychology behind how that belief system can influence their behavior, and it makes it real in a sense, tangible, that we can actually study the effects of how like their belief system might affect, you know, their ethical code based on Tolkien's work might affect their behavior, just like someone's behavior might be affected by growing up Christian.
Right. Yeah. And I would say that, like, I'll give it to the Tolkienites. At least they picked a very real text, right? Like, they didn't pick something that was kind of half-baked. Like, they picked something with deep lore, its own language systems. Like, I could, it's very hyper real fantasy in of itself, whether you make it a religion or not.
They're not basing everything on like shoddily written historical fiction that's just poor character development and it's getting a lot of the history wrong, and or, you know, we're getting into like sci-fi with a bunch of plot holes, which we'll talk about in just a minute. And basing your religious system off of that work. I will say, I guess, in defense of what we'll talk about a little bit with the Jedi, that they're not really basing it off of Star Wars as text.
Right.
They're basing it specifically off of the Jedi, which in this case, like, at least the Tolkienists aren't basing it off of like Star Wars as text.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this happened, we all believe it, we're gonna like follow the code of the Republic. Like, there's a lot of problems with that as literature compared to
Tolkien. I will give it to the Jediites, are they just Jedi?
They're just Jedi.
The George Lucas original films like hit that collective unconscious sweet spot in such a way that I could like the
absolutely
egregore that is developed out of that makes sense to me.
Oh yeah, no, George Lucas, the original trilogy is steeped in Yoon and Joseph Campbell to the point where like if you deny that, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
it is textbook Hero with a Thousand Faces. It is textbook Jungian archetypes. It is textbook mysticism and ancient religion.
Like, it just hits all the points that it's immediately memeable. It traveled far. Yeah. It's still going. Like, it makes sense that a hyper-real religion would develop out of that.
Mm-hmm. And the same with Tolkien's work. I mean, Tolkien isn't really hitting. I mean, he I think is to some extent, but before, a lot of that was more like public consciousness, but he's hitting these kind of points within a story. But what makes Tolkien special is just the amount of work and dedication and notes and world building that was done to make it just, it comes across as real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could definitely see someone getting like a doctoral degree in Tolkienism. There's so much material.
Yeah.
Like, we take it very seriously and it takes itself very seriously. Mm-hmm. So like, obviously it would translate in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It might as well be real.
And you know, again, when you're reading it, if it hits that spark, if it processes those thoughts in your mind, if you can visualize it, it is real.
Or slog through it like you're studying theology.
The Silmarillion, at least, yeah. And if you like the Silmarillion and you're listening to this, good on you. Like, it's cool. Like, I love the lore. I'm just not the one that needs to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like trying to read it in the middle of like working on an academic degree. It's like, I'm already reading enough. I want to read something a little more lighthearted. So I'll just read The Lord of the Rings again, or a little less than the Silmarillion. So
I think both of these, and we'll do your deep dive into Jediism, but I do want to make the like go back to the definition of the simulacrum. Like, we are talking about symbolic structures and memes here, and so like they have a different quality as opposed to like people who believe that they are communing directly with a deity and experiencing magical phenomena and miracles and are enacting change through prayer and stuff like that. And so
both of these groups are very like
they're heady.
Yeah, I mean, they're supreme deities, but you don't pray to the supreme deity in Tolkienism, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you might, I don't know.
I mean, you might like venerate the Valar or the Vanar,
right? The Valar.
Valar, yeah.
Or the Maiar.
Yeah, you might venerate them, but I mean, it is true. Like, Gandalf did show up on the shores of Middle Earth and then, like, you know, did stuff, was tangible within the world. So,
anyway. I did learn while I was researching. So, the three Elven Rings of Power. So, Gladriel had one.
Yep.
And then, shoot, what's
his name? Do you want me to name them? Because I know this.
The Elrond had the second.
Yep.
And then Gandalf had the third.
Yep. Do you know who had the third before Gandalf?
It was an Elven king who fought in the first battle against Sauron, and he gave it to Gandalf because he thought he was going to die.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. And what's important about that ring is that it inspires rebellion and action and defiance
in
the people around them, which is why they were able to keep the both the Hobbit crew and the Fellowship together in defiance against Smaug and Sauron.
Yeah. Gil-galad. I'm pretty Gil-galad. Sure.
Ha ha ha. No, I did jump into the lore quite a bit. I watched some YouTube videos and I was like, oh, I'm just gonna keep listening to these.
Yeah. It's like listening to a history lecture.
Nope.
It does.
It scratches a particular itch that like you don't get with most fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I went on a deep dive not too long ago. I was watching a ton of Tolkien lore.
Who knows? Maybe I'll become a Tolkienist and like build a shrine to Gandalf.
I mean, there are worse people to build a shrine, you know, worse individuals, fictional characters, beings to build shrines to. Gandalf's pretty
better
good.
Gandalf than Cthulhu.
I mean Gandalf's not likely to drive you mad. So but
he's
I don't
just
know
likely to drag my ass to a mountain.
It's true, but you know, you gotta fight the dark powers that be. The Jedi are a little more controversial because if we're talking about like original trilogy, you know, then we get into like some of the weird politics of like the Jedi in the prequels where, you know, in my opinion, it's the Jedi who are wrong. Because, man, do they just not see what's right in front of them? They've become a little too comfortable. But not modern Jedi. So Jediism is a philosophical system based on the Jedi Code. It has been used as a joke religion, but it was officially recognized in, I think it was 2005. In 2005, the Jedi Order was registered in Texas. It was granted IRS tax exemption in 2015. And then in 2007, author Daniel Jones founded the Church of Jediism with his brother in the UK, believing that the 2001 UK census recognized Jediism as a religion, and they had some credence because there were more registered Jedi than there were Scientologists, and Scientology was viewed as a religion in Britain. In 2009, and I have to read this quote because this is from like the Wikipedia article, but I came across it. In 2009, he was removed from a Tesco supermarket in Bangor, North Wales, for refusing to remove his hood on religious basis. The owner of the Tesco justified Jones's ejection by saying he's not been banned. Jedis are very welcome to shop in our stores, although we would ask them to remove their hoods. Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda, and Luke Skywalker all appeared hoodless without ever going to the dark side. And we are only aware that the Emperor was the only one who has never removed his hood. So we got him. There was worry with this bill that was being proposed in Scotland in 2013. The Free Church of Scotland was basically speaking out against this marriage and civil partnership bill by saying that like it will lead Star Wars Jedi marrying couples. And so Jones showed up and said, what's wrong with that? Like, we should be able to, if we are a recognized religion. Though the UK Charity Commission removed their charitable status, and they basically said, well, it doesn't matter. We're still going to collect money and we're still going to help people. through charitable work, even if we're not a registered charity. So we don't get like the benefits of being a charity, but we're still going to go out and do charitable work. They're still going to promote. Oh, it said that the Temple of the Jedi Order did not, quote, promote moral or ethical improvement, by basically saying that they're not the same as another different church. There are a number of these too. So depending on whether you're in Texas or the UK, there are a couple of variations of this. The UK has viewed them as not a religion, even though they've got more people claiming to be them than some other religious communities in their in the country. And there are like three major websites that I found that kind of talk about. So there is the Jedi Church, and I believe this is the one in Texas. New Zealand. I think
the Texas one is the Temple of the Jedi or the Jedi Temple or something.
Temple
like
of the
that.
Jedi Order. Yeah. So the Jedi Church is in New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
There are a number of links to like churches and other communities, but some of those don't exist anymore. It looks like either the community is like disbanded or they've kind of gone their own way. But like the three major ones that still exist is the New Zealand Jedi Church, which is jedichurch.org. The Church of Jediism, which is the one based in the UK, run by Jones. And the Temple of the Jedi Order, which is the one in Texas. So the International Church of Jediism. And they're really fascinating too. They're probably the one that I found the most kind of general information on like what the Jedi believe, who they are. They are tax deductible 501c3 nonprofit organization in the United States. They were founded in 2005. And it says that they follow the principles of Jediism, a real Jedi religion and philosophy. Jedi followers, ministers, and leaders embrace Jediism as a real living, breathing religion and sincerely believe in its teachings. Jediism does not base its focus on myth and fiction, but in the real life issues and philosophies that are the source of myth. So this really starts to like border the line between like, all right, they're definitely using the symbology or at least the concepts, because they're not even using the symbols. There's a new symbol that they've created. They're using the symbology and the concepts derived from Star Wars pop culture. But they are taking what George Lucas kind of based Jedi mythology on and saying, all right, well, we can look at Buddhism and Taoism, and we can look at these kind of Eastern systems that are kind of like the basis of like interconnection between all living things, this like living force that kind of exists within the universe. And kind of saying, we're going to use that as the basis though. And so it's really kind of hard to parse out. It's almost like the perfect in between those two paths, where they're both taking the religion and adding Jedi to it, but they're also using Jedi to, they're also building up based on like a Jedi code.
Right. So
these are the tenets of the Jedi Order from the Temple of the Jedi Order in Texas. The Jedi believe in the Force, and they believe in the Force and the inherent worth of all life within it. In the sanctity of the human person, they oppose the use of torture and cruel or unusual punishment, including the death penalty. They believe in a society governed by laws grounded in reason and compassion, not in fear and prejudice. They believe in a society that does not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or circumstances of birth, such as gender, ethnicity, and national origin. Basically anyone. We're all connected to the Force. They believe in the ethic of reciprocity and how moral concepts are not absolute, but vary by culture, religion, and over time. They believe in the positive influence of spiritual growth and awareness on society. They believe in the importance of freedom and conscience and self-determination within religious, political, and other structures. And they believe in the separation of religion and government and the freedoms of speech, association, and expression. And we're talking 2005, so it's right at the beginning of the new atheist movement.
No, and this is sounding like a friendlier version of the Satanic Temple.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I got from reading theirs. And there's a lot of similar stuff when you look at the Church of Jediism or the Jedi Church, that like they follow the Jedi Code, which is emotion yet peace. Let's see. someone innate inside of everyone. The Jedi Church believes that our sense of morality is innate. So quiet your mind, listen to the force within you. It's a lot about introspection. I came across this interesting piece about, like, should we carry weapons in a civilized society? And they were like, well, we as the church are not here to answer that question, but here are some questions you can ask yourself. And it was a lot about, like, sit down and meditate and think about these particular questions. Like, should we, like, should a civilized society require that? Or, like, why do we need to carry a weapon? Like, it, you know, is our environment, does our environment maybe facilitate the need to do that? Or something like that. Yeah, so it's emotion yet peace, ignorance yet knowledge, passion yet serenity, chaos yet harmony, death yet the force. Sounds like a kind of a combination of the Jedi code from the expanded universe and the Sith code. It's kind of like a balance between the two. But yeah, it's really fascinating that they had this kind of a very interconnectivity. It's very much like, it sounds to me a lot like a very friendly satanic temple of, like, you got this group of people who are like, yeah, look, we should all get along. We can do our own thing. Other people can do their own thing, but, like, we need to respect the people around us because we are all part of the same human community. We are all one with the force, and that goes with everything. You know, everything is one with the force. And so, yeah, it's really fascinating kind of deep diving into some of this.
Yeah.
And I have ordered the book. I ordered a used copy of, what is it called? It's like Become One with the Force. But it's the Church of Jediism book. It's, but there's a couple of others. But yeah.
Cool.
So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it is, to me, it's very different than Tolkienism. They're not really saying that, like, Jedi were real.
Right.
They're not really saying that, like, Star Wars happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. What they're saying is that there are a set of kind of beliefs and structures that kind of dictated or helped to create the concept of what a Jedi is. And we can kind of fulfill that same role as being kind of stewards of the universe, as we are part of this interconnected community. By following these tenets, we in turn are living up to the spirit of what a Jedi should be, while basing it on kind of that modern or the religious, earthly religious views of, like, interconnection between all things.
Right. And, like, adopting other religious practices of meditation and introspection and stuff like that.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And there's plenty of stuff. Like, you can go to the Temple of the Jedi Order. They put some sermons together that people have written on all sorts of things. There's just pages upon pages. And there's new stuff. There was something written on the 22nd of this month. So, you know, that we're
recording. They're still going.
They're still definitely writing and working on stuff. And yeah, they have so much information on their website. Yeah, their three tenets are focus, knowledge, and wisdom. And then the code. Yeah, there is no emotion. There is peace. There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. There is no passion, there is serenity. There is no chaos, there is harmony. There is no death, there is the force. And so, they have a creed. They have the 16 teachings. I'm not going to read them all, but we'll link their websites.
Right on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you've said some of your students have been reporting on Jediism. Are there any questions that you've had, like, as you've been?
There's, like, I don't know. They've pretty much told me everything you just told me. I didn't know that they were still as active. There was they seemed to jive with it a lot. Like, they were surprised, but then as they went through the reading, and let me see if I can pull up that reading. Maybe we can link that as well that I had them do.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who wrote it. But it pretty much walked through like, hey, this started out as like a joke religion, but now people are taking it seriously. And this is kind of aspects of fandom that go into this. And so they started off kind of critical or surprised. And then as they walk their way through the podcast, they're like, actually, no, this makes sense. Like, there's kind of a arbitrariness to what kind of religious structure you choose. And they're pretty, the class is pretty chaotic in that way. They're just like, sure, believe in Jedi, whatever.
I mean, the basis behind what they're talking about is all positive stuff. Like, it's the golden rule with additional, like, with added stuff. It's treat people with respect. We're all in this together. General harmony. Like, I mean, I'm sure people are gonna, some people will look at that and be like, this is terrible.
It is Passami, the Adam Passami, with Murray Lee, Hyper Real Religions, Fear, Anxiety, and Late Modern Religious Innovations. And they identified, they were inspired to write about Jediism because, let's see, in 2001, 71,000 Australians identified as Jedi. They also talked about, because they're from Australia, they also talked about the other countries that they had. Let's see, 400,000 in the UK and 53,000 in New Zealand in those 2001-2002 censuses. So if you want to learn more about hyper-real religions, Passami, I hope I'm saying their name right, is the go-to author for this.
Yeah, cool. So it looks good. And to kind of filter on this idea of like how we take Taoism and other works, and it's been adapted using pop cultural references, I'm going to bring us to our ism of the week.
Huzzah!
So this is a religion, philosophy, or lifestyle inspired by the protagonist of the Coen Brothers' 1998 film, The Big Lebowski. It is Dudism.
Dudism.
And like, I'm all in. I think I'm gonna switch. The Dudist logo looks like it's like a purple and green yin yang, but it has three dots in each of the. So its primary objective is to promote a modern form of Taoism, blended with concepts of Epicurus, but presented in a style personified by Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski.
Right on.
And it's fantastic. Their philosophy is Taoism stripped of all its metaphysical and medical doctrines. Uh-huh. It advocates and encourages the practices of, quote, going with the flow, being cool-headed, and taking it easy in the face of life's difficulties. That's the only way to live in harmony with our inner nature, and the challenges of interacting with other people is doing that. Is like, cool. You just kind of have to go with it and you can't let it stress you out, man.
It sounds like your spirit animal from a couple episodes ago, the turtle.
Absolutely. Like it's what I want to be, right? Yeah, they have a number of prominent dudes. These are like the great dudes in history that they say is like are representative of like what can also be tied into it. So it makes use of iconography and narrative from the film, but they argue that the Dudist worldview has existed since the beginning of civilization, primarily to correct societal tendencies toward excess and aggression.
Okay.
And they list individuals such as Lao Tzu, who's tied to the Tao teaching, Epicurus, Heraclitus, Buddha, the pre-ecclesiastical, I can never say that right, Jesus Christ, are examples of, quote, great dudes in history. And more recent antecedents include pillars of American transcendentalism, such as Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, and humanists such as Kurt Vonnegut and Mark Twain.
Okay.
And they Mark still, Twain's a dude. Yeah, they have the Dudes paper It's a official publication that they've been putting out since 2008. And they've written a number of books that they actually kind of rewrote the Tao Te Ching as the Dude Te Ching. There's another book by Oliver Benjamin called The Tao of the Dude. And so, yeah.
Cool. Would they qualify as a hyper-real religion as well?
Yeah, I mean, they're taking a pre-existing religious system. They're stripping out some of the aspects, but they're adding and they're presenting it through the format of The Big Lebowski. So I picked it because it arguably fits the criteria of a hyper-real religion.
Cool.
And it is a current, it's been around for over a decade. So
that's neat.
I might.
So you're gonna become a dudist now.
I might become a dudist. Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna have to buy the book and like read through it. But like, hey, you know, it makes sense. Just go with the flow, man. Take it easy. Be cool-headed.
Live your inner turtle spirit animal fantasy.
Yeah. So, dudism.
Dudism. Right on.
Right on, man.
Right yeah. on.
So now I have to go back, and I'm not only going to go back and like read Tolkien, but I'm going to watch The Big Lebowski again. So
we're just going to reorient our lives around hyper-real religions this summer.
Yeah, yeah, that, and possibly go and summon the Watcher.
We should do that.
Should we?
I mean, we shouldn't. But
yeah,
I want to.
And on that note, goodbye.
Goodbye.